Silence is command.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. I will call the third case for today, 2005 AP 1042, HSBC Realty Credit Corporation versus the City of Glendale. Daniel Kelly, representing the Bayshore Town Center. Counsel.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the Court, my name is Daniel Kelly, and it is my honor to represent Bayshore Town Center, LLC, in this matter. The question before the Court is who should benefit from the deposit of a condemnation award meant to stand in the place of real estate that was taken by the Glendale CDA in the power of its eminent domain. There are three possibilities. One, the owner of the property. Two, the clerk. Or three, the bank in which the money is actually deposited. The Circuit Court decided, consistently with the statutory authority that it had, that the award should go to the benefit, should be deposited for the benefit of the award owners, and made an order accordingly. The Court of Appeals disagreed, holding that whoever benefits from the deposit of the award, it ought not be the owners. The Court of Appeals must be reversed because, in the words of the dissent, the majority reached its conclusion by, quote, misreading the clear language of section 59.40 sub 3, close quote, thereby allowing Milwaukee County to, quote, hijack funds that section 32.05 sub 7 sub D says belongs to others. In addition, the Court of Appeals must be reversed to avoid a constitutional conflict. I begin our analysis with respect to the statute, and the analysis ought to end there as well, because we believe that the statutory language is dispositive of this matter. The legislature in this case did a very solid job of developing a statutory scheme that balances two interests. The first is to give the county an opportunity to invest and retain earnings on funds that are in its accounts. The second is preserving the court's discretion to determine that the award ought to be held for the benefit of someone other than the clerk. The way it did this is accomplished in section 59.40 sub 3. Subparagraph B gives the county a temporary conditional opportunity to use other people's money for its own benefit. That ability is expressly conditioned upon the very next paragraph in that statute. Paragraph C. And paragraph C says the judge in any given case may declare that paragraph B does not apply. So what that accomplishes is to name the clerk as a default beneficiary of the deposit of funds that it finds in its accounts.
Paragraph I don't know if it's a beneficiary or whether it's in control of the investment. Of course, you could have the circuit court decide where it be invested, but that the beneficiary still be the county.
Well, if the county is retaining the earnings on the investment, it is by definition a beneficiary. It is possible that a court could, within the exercise of its discretion, decide that the court may do the investment, but that the earnings be diverted to an alternative beneficiary. But if the county does retain the funds, it is the beneficiary.
Mr. Kelly, what do you respond to the argument that's made by your opponent that 5943 B and C are really not determinative here, and that you really have to look at 3205 7D, and that doesn't say anything about the circuit court having any authority to decide where the money goes, but rather it says that the money, one of the alternatives is be deposited with the clerk of the circuit court, and that's what controls here.
Thank you, Justice Crux. I agree that 32.05 is wrapped up entirely in the disposition of this question. Continuing with the quotation that you referred to, the end of the quote is that it be deposited for the benefit of the award owner. And that is the primary response that we have to the clerk's position. The veto authority found in 5940 sub 3 sub C says that the clerk may not invest. And the clerk admits that. He admits that the court can tell them they may not invest. 3205 sub 7 sub D then informs the circuit court who the beneficiary of the award ought to be. And it says it in no uncertain terms. It is to be deposited for the benefit of the owner.
Why couldn't you interpret that provision as indicating that the benefit is indeed being received by the persons named in the award, in that that money is being protected? Not necessarily that they're going to get interest from it, but rather it's in a good, safe place.
I think it would make that language superfluous if it was interpreted in that manner. The statutory command that it be deposited for the benefit of the award owners is unique in all of Wisconsin statutes. There is no other provision in all of our statutes that indicates that money ought to be deposited for the benefit of an identified party, and in this case, identified as the owners of the award. And I think it would make the language logically inconsistent, because one of the obvious benefits of a deposit of an award is the interest that it earns. And if the clerk is retaining the earnings, then the clerk is benefiting from the deposit of the award.
Counselor, is the inconsistency you talk about the fact that if the condemnor had not paid the money into the clerk of court, it would in fact be required to pay interest on the money that it held?
Well, and that is an alternative way of looking at it. Until the deposit, and we discussed this in the constitutional section of our argument, but until the award is made immediately available to the condemnee, the condemnor is liable for interest on that, on those funds.
Okay, so by paying it into court, then the condemnor is off the hook for interest, and the question is, are other opportunities then available to the condemnees, or do they have to leave it with the clerk where the statute requires it to be paid?
And part of that does get into the constitutional argument, because our position is that the condemnor does not necessarily get off the hook by depositing the award in the court for interest. It does so only when it does it in such a way as the funds are immediately available for withdrawal. If the condemnor deposits the funds in such a way that the owners cannot immediately withdraw it, then the condemnor continues to be liable, or someone continues to be liable for interest, because interest is a constitutionally mandated part of just compensation.
Okay.
But we don't need to get there, because the statutes do indicate not only that the court has the discretion to redirect the benefit of the award, but we also have 3205 that identifies who ought to be the beneficiary.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. I want to follow up on Justice Crook's question in interpreting 3205-7D, the words for the benefit of. I certainly understand the argument that for the benefit of might or does or should include interest. But I'm not compelled by the argument that those words for certain include interest. I'm particularly bothered as the statute continues, and it says the persons entitled thereto may receive their proper share of the award. It doesn't make any reference to interest. So I'm asking you to really continue expounding on your response to Justice Brooks.
I'll pick up where I left off, which is that the language needs to be interpreted in a logically consistent fashion. There is benefit that will flow from the deposit of the award. The statute says the benefit belongs to Bayshore. One of the benefits of a deposit, in fact, one of the primary benefits of the deposit of an award, is the interest that accrues while it's on deposit. If that language is construed such that that benefit flows to the clerk instead of the owners, that contravenes the very language of the statute that says the benefit will go to the owner.
Here, You are answering my question with a given, and I'm not taking the given. I'm not taking as a given that depositing the award for the benefit of the persons named in the award automatically means that any interest earning is also deposited. It can be different, and the difference seems to me to be perhaps highlighted in that the second sentence afterwards when it just talks about, oh, so, okay, if you want the money. It doesn't say it quite that generally. It says, okay, if you want the award, doesn't mention anything about interest, then petition the court. So it seems like it could be just talking about the award and not interest whatsoever.
Very good. And I will take, and for the sake of responding to your question, perhaps it would be helpful for me to do this. I will assume that for the benefit part of that language doesn't even exist. Even in the absence of for the benefit language in that statute, we believe that the circuit court was well within its authority to order the transfer of the funds to an account where it would bear interest for the benefit of the owners. And that is, it is the precise reason why we put in the section of our brief with respect to inherent and equitable authority. That is the discretionary power that the circuit court has to preserve the rights and interests of the litigants before the court and preserve the value and integrity of the race of the lawsuit. So even without a statute saying there is the legislature saying we're nominating an alternative beneficiary to what 5940 sub 3 sub B states, even without that language, the court has the authority in his discretion to decide that in the preservation of the interests and rights of the people in front of his court and the value of the award, he can transfer that to an account where it will bear interest for the benefit of the owners of the award.
Tell you what's one of the things that's bothering me about this case is, as a circuit court judge in those thrilling days of yesteryear, I would often have minor settlements in civil cases, and inevitably, or some other kinds of settlement money or guardianship money that I'm holding, or the court's holding, or the clerk's holding, I guess. Court wasn't holding it, that's for sure. And I'd get these people coming in and saying, oh, it's just killing us that this isn't in some kind of an account. You know, we would say it has to be in a federally deposited in a federally insured, you know, and something that's going to make 2 or 3% interest, you know, nothing. And you'd kind of have these attorneys come in and say, boy, there's this gas and oil limited partnership. I mean, you know, it's going to explode, Judge.
And it did,
but it tanked, you know. And so you can't have that because there's a good deal around every corner. And I don't think the courts, number one, shouldn't be in the business of deciding what investment is a good investment. And number two, not only are they not equipped to do it, from a point of view of time and economy, we don't have time to be doing that kind of stuff. We could be inundated. Can you respond to how this opinion in no way affects what my concern is?
In this way, Your Honor. There were approximately 18 named interested persons in the condemnation award. When we moved the court for a transfer of the funds to the account where it would earn interest for the benefit of the owners, we served all of those parties. The only party that appeared in court for the hearing was HSBC. And they appeared to support our motion. Not a single dissent was heard with respect to this motion. The reason that when there is potentially disputed funds, that they need to be put in the most highly protected accounts available is because there are other stakeholders who are potentially impacted by what happens with that money. In this case, everybody agreed this is what ought to be done with the money. So to the extent that if a case ever came before the court in which there was another stakeholder that dissented, that said, you know, I'm not comfortable with it getting moved to a money market account. I want it to be insured up to the maximum extent possible. Then the court would certainly have the discretion to say either, okay, it goes into X kind of account that's rock solid, gold guaranteed, or simply to deny the request entirely and say, no, it's going to stay on deposit with the clerk. So having the discretion to make the type of order that Judge Stankovich did in this case does not lead to a requirement that such an order always be granted. The specific considerations of any given case will inform the court's judgment, and they'll make and the court will make the judgment accordingly. And if Judge Stankovich in this case had decided he was too busy to put the thought into how these funds ought to be directed and moved or kept on account, he could have simply declined to exercise his discretionary authority. But he decided, given the circumstances, the lack of objections, the amount of money involved, the interests of the litigants, the protection of the case before the court, that this was the most appropriate disposition of the award.
If it was requested that they put it in gas and oil, under your interpretation of the statute, that is sub C of 5943C, could he have?
Well, I think that if all of the parties with a stakeholder interest in the funds decided, yeah, this is what we want done with the money, I think he could have. Because the point of having it deposited in a particular place is for the protection of the parties before the court. And if all the parties say this is an appropriate disposition of the funds.
And the source of the judge's authority to do that again, you're arguing, stems from where?
Well, it begins with 5940 sub 3 sub C.
I want to stop you there because that's where I'm having some problem.
Okay.
If you have 5940 sub 3, C says that paragraph B does not apply.
Correct.
All right. Or the judge may decide the paragraph B. So let's assume that the judge decides that paragraph B doesn't apply.
Yes.
Paragraph B, as I understand it, is the authority for the clerk to invest.
Right.
So where is the authority for the clerk to invest?
Well, after the judge exercises the judicial veto of paragraph C, there is no authority left with the clerk to invest. The court may then, in that circumstance, because that statutory authority is no longer there,
right,
he can exercise his discretionary authority that is founded in inherent and equitable authority to direct the funds somewhere else.
So in order to support your position, we would have to reach the inherent authority of the trial court and the constitutional issue with respect to interest. Is that correct?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. To support our position, the only thing necessary is to find that paragraph C means what it says, and that is that a court in any given case can tell the clerk you may not invest, and then look to 3205 sub 7 sub D, find that the legislature has indicated that the deposit ought to be for the benefit of the award owners, and then that is sufficient authority to uphold the circuit court's order in this case.
Well, that doesn't get you the investment. That's why I'm saying it seems to me, unless I'm misreading your argument, one, that they're entitled to interest, and that's a constitutional claim, and two, that the circuit court has some inherent powers to do it in the absence of the statutory authority, because you just agreed that the statute, once the judge invokes the veto under sub C, the statute under sub B doesn't apply. So it's not just that he doesn't have to invest it in this particular account, it's that the authority to invest by the clerk is gone. So it seems to me in order to reach your position, we would have to reach both inherent authority and the constitutional issue regarding the right to interest while this money is still held by the clerk. Is that correct?
I would not agree, Your Honor, respectfully, because I do think that 3205 sub 7 sub D is sufficient statutory authority to inform the judge that the court may move those funds out of the clerk's account into a different account. Now, absent that, then the next step is to have reference to inherent and equitable authority. And therein, I think you find completely sufficient discretionary authority in the circuit court.
Well, here's the problem that I have with the argument under 3205-7D. Deposit it with the clerk for the benefit of the person's name in the award. Okay. Each of the courts have safes available for it. I mean, I was a circuit judge over in Milwaukee, and we had safes in the back. There was often evidence that was brought in. We would take the evidence and we would lock it in the safe. It's done for the protection of the evidence, or in this case, it would be done for the protection of the parties who have this money available to it. Why can't we construe the statute to say that as long as the clerk is protecting the money, that any investment is required? I'm not sure that investment goes hand in hand with 3205 sub 7. That's the problem. I have the same problem that Justice Bradley asked you about, that you seem to assume that investment is part of the statute, and I'm not sure it is.
And I'm happy to assume. I think that 3205 does provide for that, but I'm happy to assume for the sake of argument that it doesn't.
Okay.
If it does not, then what the court is faced with is, how do I protect the rights of the litigants before the court? How do I preserve the value of the race? And the court is fully capable of considering the fact that money, as opposed to, say, something like a Van Gogh painting, has a certain time value. And he knows that if he stashes it in the safe in the court's chambers, that it's actually sitting there losing value. It's not maintaining its value. It's losing value. So, and here I would actually parse a little bit more finely the concept of interest with respect to interest to protect time value, interest with respect to just compensation. The inherent and equitable authority is to say, I understand as a circuit court judge that the money sitting in my safe is losing value right now. I have the inherent and equitable authority to stop that from happening. I can do that by the consent of all the parties in front of me, depositing it into this money market account. I know there that there is less of a chance that it's going to continue to devalue. The interest with respect to just compensation is a slightly different thing. In the just compensation context, interest is not awarded qua interest. It is as a rough marker of the fair, perfect, and complete just compensation that a person receives when the property is taken under eminent domain. It's been used as just a rough approximation. So we say that to keep the value of a just compensation award just, we're going to use the concept of interest to bump up that value while it's being litigated. So that's the constitutional piece. But certainly from simply in any given case, even in a non-condemnation case, when there is a fund of money that is being litigated, the circuit court certainly can look at that and say, to stop the erosion, the passage of time, the value of that race, we will consider depositing it somewhere where it will earn interest for the benefit of the parties in front of the court.
Mr. Kelly, let's assume that you're right and you win on that issue. What about the sub-issue, if you will, that the clerk is still entitled to a fee for being involved in all of this under 814.61 and under 757.25? How do you respond to that?
That's a fair question, Your Honor. I begin with the fundamental proposition that the clerk is entitled to only those fees for which he is specifically statutorily authorized. 814.61 makes reference to 757.25, and 757.25 does not apply because that only comes into effect when the depositing party is the same one asking for an order transferring the award. In this case, the Glendale CDA, which is not even a party to the case, is the one who deposited the award. It is Bayshore Town Center that asked for the transfer of the award. So in the absence of identity between the parties making the deposit and making the request, 757.25 simply does not apply.
Now, I didn't look at 807.10.3, but that's also referred to in 814.61. Does that apply at all?
I'll let you know in a minute.
It's 807.10.3.
Well, this appears, 807.10 appears to deal with settlements on behalf of minors. Mm-hmm. And so, since we don't have any minors involved in this action, I don't think it would apply.
Fine.
807.10?
Why not? I still get back to my worry
It seems to me that when we're dealing with 59.43C, that says a judge may direct that paragraph B does not apply to certain funds. B, of course, says the clerk may invest. So C wipes out B, but C doesn't say, therefore, the judge may invest. It doesn't say that. So you go to inherent authority.
Right.
And when you go into inherent authority, it makes me nervous. Doesn't mean that the court doesn't have any the inherent authority. I'm a big believer in inherent authority. But sometimes inherent authority is better kind of quiet. And I'm concerned if we say judges have inherent authority to invest any monies deposited, then they will be besieged to invest minor settlement funds. How about the money that you set aside? You're going to do a custody study. You need mediation. This is a highfalutin, folks. Each of you pay $10,000 into the court because this is going to be a really contested divorce case with custody. Okay, judge, we'll do that, but we want that to go to Edward Jones' money market. No, we don't want it to go to et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we don't want to be in that business.
Well, we can whisper inherent authority, but I think that we speak of equitable authority in conversational tones. what you're proposing is already the case in every circuit court that's out there. Every time there is any race in dispute, the parties are always going to be seeking to maintain the advantage of that race, and they will besiege the court with motion after motion to make sure that the value of what it is that they're seeking relief for is protected.
Well, what is the practice? I know it's not part of the record, but I mean, this must be, if not an everyday event, fairly frequent in civil cases, that there's a sum of money put in, and then person who put it in said, you guys figure out what to do with it.
Well, I think that if you're referring to the type of situation where there's an interpleader, I think that we veer off into a separate but related realm because there are no constitutional overtones
right.
to interpleader funds.
What does the court do?
Well, I do know, and this is not in the record, of course, but from my personal practice, I'm aware that when we have interpleader type mm-hmm. situations, in that context, in business disputes over the allocation of purchase price, we do everything we can to come to agreement with the other party to put the funds in an account where it will be under the court control or in an escrow type of a situation. So.
With interest?
I'm sorry?
With interest?
With interest.
Okay.
Absolutely. Now, in a context like this, as a practical matter, I think we have to keep the eye on the ball on what's going to happen with this. 5940 sub 3 sub C, the purpose of exercising that judicial veto is not just to deprive the clerk of the ability to earn interest. The account that he's got his money put in are essentially gold-plated. They're not going to go anywhere. They're not at risk. There's never, I dare say, a need to grant greater protection to the loss of the funds themselves as a corpus. The point of exercising the judicial veto is not express, but as a practical matter, the whole point of that is to nominate an alternative beneficiary. Because then, if it's not that, then the situation you're left with is the beneficiary of the deposit of the ward is the bank. Because the bank gets to use the money and doesn't have to pay anyone any interest. And the bank is nowhere named in any of the statutes as any potential beneficiary of the deposit of a condemnation award.
If you prevail, Mr. Kelly, what are the fiscal implications for county government?
Well, that's hard to know. And as the Court of Appeals noted as it went through a very thorough analysis of the legislative history of 5940 sub 3 sub B, there were always notations in that legislative history that it was hard to know how often a court would exercise the judicial veto provided for by paragraph C. So I don't know what the financial impact will be. I would suggest, however, that in the context of a condemnation award, that would be an improper factor to take into account in construing these statutes. In a non-condemnation context, certainly that would be something that could inform the circuit court's discretion as he decides whether or not to exercise the judicial veto. But in the context of condemnation awards, because of the constitutional overtones, I think that would be inappropriate, because not only does 3205, and I do believe that when it says that it is to be deposited for the benefit of the award owner, that includes whatever benefit flows from the deposit. It does not parse it out. It just says it shall benefit the owner. So I think that does include interest.
Does interest on a condemnation award become taxable to...
It does not. It is the interest, along with the corpus, stands in the place of the property that was condemned. So there are no tax implications for the interest that's earned. And again, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, interest in a constitutional context on a condemnation award is simply a rough approximation of how to maintain the basic underlying award value, so that when it's actually dispersed, the person receives the full, perfect, and complete compensation to which the Constitution guarantees him. There are no other questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mark A. Grady, Principal Assistant Corporation Counsel, representing Clerk's Office.
May it please the Court, Justice Abramson. My name is Mark Grady. I am an Assistant Corporation Counsel, and I'm here representing John Barrett, who is present in court today, the Clerk of Circuit Court of Milwaukee County. I must first say that we strongly disagree with the basic premise upon which Bayshore's argument proceeds. Bayshore has no right to interest on this condemnation award in this case, constitutional, statutory, or otherwise. The case law which Bayshore cites for its claim to interest in the constitutional context are all cases completely different in fact and procedural setting from this one. Those cases stand for the proposition, which is undisputed, that if a condemnor takes property and delays in its payment for that property, it owes interest for that delay. That's what the Kirby case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, which Bayshore cites, stands for. There are other cases cited in the briefs where condemnors pay money into court and then through some motion or otherwise interfere with the condemnee's withdrawal of that money from the court. In those cases, interest is owed because of the condemnor's action. And that interest, by the way, is from the condemnor as part of the compensation for the eminent domain taking. In this case, Glendale paid the condemnation award on the same day that it took the property. There was no delay by Bayshore or by Glendale in making its payment of the condemnation award. Under those circumstances, the case law from every case cited in the briefs is clear that there is no interest owed by the condemnor because the payment occurred simultaneously with the taking. And in that sense, this is not a condemnation case, because Bayshore has no right to interest from Glendale. What Bayshore wants is interest from the clerk. That is not a condemnation action. And if Bayshore cannot get interest as part of its condemnation award from the condemnor, the city of Glendale, then just compensation has been paid.
Is the only avenue by which the clerk asserts any right to this $14 million some odd, what is found in the statute?
Yes, the clerk's authority to invest this money is found in 5943B and its predecessor statute.
So absent that provision of the statutes, the clerk could accept the payment but would just have to sit on it, correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. Follow-up.
I'm sorry.
How is this arrangement among the stakeholders here any different than any other stipulation that all the parties to a lawsuit bring to a judge and the judge rules on and says these parties own this property and they agree we're going to do A with it. How is this this order any different from any other stipulation among the parties to the lawsuit?
I would suggest to you that if the clerk were interested in those other cases, he would have standing to object in those other cases in the same fashion that we have objected in this case.
How is the clerk interested, though? We've agreed that he has no right to the $14 million. His only right to invest it comes from the statute. So if the judge can take away the statutory right to invest, which your brief agrees the judge can do, then all the clerk could do was sit on the money, correct?
Correct.
So if the clerk is sitting on the money and the parties to the action stipulate that another alternative is where the money should go, I don't see how this order of the court, which is based on an implicit stipulation of the parties, any different than any other stipulation about what parties do with money until they decide how they're going to distribute it as part of a lawsuit.
If it were not for 3205.7d, which says this money shall be paid to the clerk,
mm-hmm.
then the parties are probably free to essentially stipulate to allow the court, the circuit court, to put money wherever they want the court to put it. But this statute, 3205.7d, says a condemnation award shall be either paid to the condemnee owner or to the clerk of circuit court.
Right.
And because it's paid in the clerk of circuit court, there's no statutory authority to take it elsewhere, and parties, I do not believe, can stipulate to create authority within the circuit court that's not there. Contrary to a statute which says this money shall reside with the clerk for safekeeping.
But if I buy your argument, I would have to believe that the legislature enacted subsection C to prevent anybody from getting any interest, the clerk or the parties. And I don't really see why that makes any sense at all, particularly not on $14 million.
There may be an instance where a judge in a particular case does not want this money invested because it's going to be dispersed in a short time frame. He or she may want to say, I want the clerk to just hold this, put it in the drawer, if you will, or put it in the safe, if you will, and hold it because I'm about to make an order within 3 days or 2 days or whatever. And so there may be circumstances where a circuit court doesn't want the clerk to go out and invest the money. I believe that, in fact, is the situation that existed prior to the change in 1979 in the statute, where the legislature said, we're going to broaden the types of funds that the clerk can invest. Funds that couldn't be invested before to now include things like condemnation awards that can be invested.
Mr. Grady, let's assume for purposes of my question that you're right and there is no constitutional right to interest here. When I look at the interplay of the statutes, and I look at 3205.7d, and once again, you kind of lopped off the end of the sentence, for the benefit of the persons named in the award, and you look at that in connection with 5943b and c, and we all agree that the circuit court, at least the parties agree, I should say, that the circuit court can direct that B does not apply, and that's the clerk's authority for investing the money and then retaining it under 6606031M. That's where that authority stems. So in the absence of that authority, since Judge Sankovitz has ruled that B does not apply in this case, we're still left with the conundrum that maybe the clerk wasn't authorized to invest the money in this particular case, but the fact remains that the clerk did invest the money in this case. And to the extent that the clerk did invest the money in this case, if you read that under 3205.7d, for the benefit of the persons named in the award, I'm struggling with how the clerk has any claim of entitlement at all to that interest.
The last clause of 5943b says the clerk shall retain the interest for his county.
But 3b doesn't apply. B is gone.
But the clerk only invested the money before the circuit court order.
I understand that, but the judge can order that the clerk can't do that. That B doesn't apply. And that apparently happened in this case. So once Judge Sankovitz issues his order, what we have is an investment that was made without statutory authorization and money that was accrued. And the question, at least one of the questions in my mind was, okay, we have this pot here. This money has grown. Somebody gets it. Who gets it? Does the clerk get it? Does the bank get it? Or does it go back to the parties for whom the award was made? And if you go back to 7D, seems to say that it's for the benefit of the persons named in the award. And so when you take away that statutory authority for investment and retention of that investment from the clerk, I'm not sure how the clerk has any claim here.
Justice Butler, I think two things I'd like to say in response. One is, chronologically, what happened is the money is placed in the clerk's hands.
Right.
He immediately has the statutory authority
right.
to invest it. So he did.
Right.
Puts it in their general fund and makes 2% on it. Sometime later.
Now, you've got a renegade circuit judge that says, I don't want B to apply. So B is gone.
and so he says B is gone. So at that point, the clerk no longer has investment authority, but that did not negate the authority he had before that court order. And so, yes, there was interest earned in that month or so that this money was invested. And your question is, who gets that month's worth of interest before the court acts? My answer is, subsection B says the clerk shall retain the interest that is earned.
So is it the county's argument that up until the point that Judge Sankovitz issued his order, the clerk has a claim to that interest, but the interest beyond that point goes back to the award claimants?
If Judge Sankovitz had made an order that merely that it shall not be invested, there would be no interest. His order obviously went beyond that, not only said it shall not be invested with the clerk, but I'm going to take it from the clerk's custody, put it in a private bank at some different, presumably higher rate of interest. And our argument is that it should never have been taken from the clerk. The judge under sub C has the authority to prevent the investment of the clerk, but nothing in C gives him the authority to take the fund itself from the clerk. That's what 32057D says. The clerk is the custodian. He is the clerk of the circuit court by constitutional office, and he is the circuit court's banker. That's what the legislature has set up. The scheme to do is for him to be the court's banker. The circuit court can decide, I don't want my clerk to play with this money, and that's what C says. But the circuit court cannot decide, I don't want my clerk to have custody of this money anymore. I like Joe Blow's bank on the corner.
No, I accept that proposition. Where I'm struggling is we've got the date of the order, and the judge says B doesn't apply. Now, judge ordered more than that, but we've got B doesn't apply. My understanding of the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the money remained in the interest-bearing account that the clerk had set up. So the question becomes, if I accept your argument, who, if anyone, is entitled to the money from the date of Judge Sankovitz's order on?
I believe, the judge's order is invalid. So that you're supposed to put the parties back to the position they would have been had the judge's order not been entered. To me, that means you give the interest to the clerk, because that's who is entitled to it, had the judge's order.
Why is that? I'm going to enter. Because it's for the benefit of the persons. And that's the whole makeup of the statute. And this is special, as opposing counsel indicated. There is no other language for any other deposit. Why should Milwaukee County benefit from money that is not theirs?
First of all, I disagree with the factual or legal statement that there is no other statutory language.
Tell me one then. I mean, that's what I'm basing this on what opposing counsel said, that this was special language. And it seems to me, and I was in the amicus, which happens to be the city of Glendale, the argument is made. And I see just from an equitable standpoint, why should the city or the taxpayers of Milwaukee County benefit from this?
The quick answer to that question is because the legislature said so. They have allocated the rights.
And you're saying because it was an illegal order that I think the legislature said that it should be deposited for the benefit of the persons named in the award.
And this goes back to Justice Bradley's question and Justice Crooks' question.
I understand.
I believe that there's no obvious reason why, for the benefit, that language, that the order or the award shall be held for the benefit of the owners, implies the additional interest.
Why not?
Because
let me ask you this. So, in other words, it's deposited for their benefit. You're saying that it could sit there for 3 or 4 years if litigation, and that there is no benefit in depositing because it's either paid to them or it's paid to the clerk. So the clerk is holding the money for people that are out their property. They lost their property. They don't have it anymore. They can't use it. You, Milwaukee County, has their property. And therefore, that's not for Milwaukee County's benefit. It would be for the benefit. And that's, I think, what the dissent is saying, that it's for the benefit. And there is no benefit. So there is no benefit under your, let's say, explanation. There is no benefit, really, for the people that had the property, that lost the property.
There is a benefit, and that is the safeguard that the clerk provides.
Well, that is a bunch of hooey, and you know it, and I know it, so I don't normally, but that is...
He didn't mean it.
Oh, yeah.
The legal term.
Don't need the legal argument. That's for, so you put it in the safe. This is the argument. But my colleagues know that I'm a short timer, but I would say that I was sitting here listening to this argument, and that one that is for someone's benefit to put it in under the mattress and save it, because that's what you're doing. I mean, it's the under the mattress argument.
But the phrase for the benefit of someone is a common phrase in the statutes and
okay,
in the
Okay, now you're going to point out to me where that is used.
Just some examples, because I actually thought of this argument this morning. I pulled out of...
Good. I just thought of my argument here. So you obviously don't draw who.
You're ahead of him. Yeah. Go ahead. You're on a winning streak.
That's my apology for it not being in the brief. Is that an easy Lexis search will find these kinds of cases. For example, 128.18 has several pieces in it. It has to do with liens, and it talks about persons holding money for the benefit of creditors. Another example is 701.06, spendthrift provisions and creditors and benefit. It talks about money being held for the benefit of settlors in trust law. There is a section in 49.454 that uses the phrase for the benefit in treatment of trust amounts. Class actions law, 803.08, talks about for the benefit of the whole, if you will. There are numerous others that I could cite. So it's a common phrase in the statute, and I do not believe that the using that phrase implies that whenever something's being done for the benefit of someone else, that interest goes with that. I understand the argument in this context, but I don't think it automatically means that. And my point...
Suppose there was a loss here.
A loss in the investment?
Yeah, of the principal. Who pays the loss? Does the county? Individuals who own a share of this fund?
Well, that was my... not intended to be tongue-in-cheek response to Justice Wilcox, is that legislature set this system up, they only gave the clerk the authority to do the investment if he did it in certain limited ways. The clerk isn't able to go out and invest it in oil and gas leases or hedge funds or anything else. And once you start down this path, as Justice Bradley mentioned, who's going to say what the right investment is or what the right interest rate is? What if Walgreens, who is one of the claimants in this case, came in and said, I don't like U.S. Bank as the stakeholder. I think it should go here because I can get an extra 0.25%. Now is the circuit court going to say, well, I've got to decide now between which stakeholder is going to hold it?
Go ahead. What I was trying to make clear is that I'm not concerned about U.S. Bank. But I think any money that's earned on this, while it's with the clerk, was for the benefit of the people that lost the property. So I'm not. There's no argument that it's 4% or 6%, perfectly satisfied with whatever the clerk is earning.
I believe, Justice, that you have to take this out of the eminent domain context, as I started to explain earlier, because it gets into the things again that Justice Bradley was mentioning, because the condemnees are not entitled to interest on a condemnation award once it's been paid and it's available to them. Just compensation does not include any interest while the competing claimants litigate their title to this parcel. And if that's the case, which I believe it is, then This same principle will apply in any situation where someone pays private money into the clerk's office. It could be bail. It could be security for costs of a non-Wisconsin plaintiff. It could be an undertaking for an appeal. It could be a wide variety of an interpleader action.
I have a question about that, which is what I asked and Justice Prosser asked your opposing counsel. How much money are we talking about per year that the clerk's office invests in Milwaukee County? Do you have a figure?
I do not have a figure for that. I could swear, Mr. Barrett, but I do not have a figure.
Round ballpark? No.
I don't even have a guess to make to you. I'm sorry.
But enough to make Milwaukee County clerk's office here.
I'm sure it is a sizable sum. How much it is, I don't know, because I'm sure we run lots and lots of litigation through our courts. We have, as you know, many branches in Milwaukee County.
Could
so I'm sure
I
it's a sizable sum. This case, obviously, is a sizable sum by itself.
I understand.
Mr. Grady, I want to make sure I understand the facts in this case. The clerk put the money in the general fund. Is that right?
I don't understand the clerk's banking, but my understanding is they have a minimum amount that they keep in their checking account. Everything else above that is siphoned off and invested overnight, and the overnight return is approximately 2% of their general fund.
And who gets that 2%?
The county, under the statute, 5943B, says the county shall retain the interest. And this is not just this condemnation award, obviously. We're talking about anything paid to the clerk, whether it's a fine, whether it's a bail, whether it's anything.
Suppose it had been the county itself that had condemned the property.
Well,
then the county would have the property, and the county would be earning interest.
If the county was the condemnor and it was paying the money into court, then I guess you're right. Under the statutory scheme, the county would in fact be earning the interest on the funds through its role as the clerk of circuit court, as the holder of the funds.
So the county would then have a real interest in hoping that the parties who were to get the payment fought as long as possible. Isn't that right?
Right. From a purely fiscal standpoint, yes.
But if it was the county's fault that this was being held, then the county would not get interest.
If it was the county's fault that this
they'd
money
be paying was, interest.
If a condemnor interferes with the condemnee's right to get at the money at the award, the condemnor is obligated to pay interest.
Right.
Had Glendale interfered in any fashion with Bayshore's right to get the money, they would owe interest. But they paid the money unconditionally to the clerk. They no longer interfered in this action in any fashion. And the only reason there is a delay is because of competing subordinate claims within this same parcel. There's an argument brought in the reply brief of Bayshore that if a condemnor fails to allocate the award between parcels, the condemnor is liable for interest. That is true, but that is not what occurred here. What occurred here is a failure, if you want to call it that, to allocate between lessees and banks and its other owners of one parcel. And there is no law that requires the condemnor to allocate in that fashion because it's an in rem proceeding. The condemnor takes the entire title with one payment, and it's left to the people who own their subordinate interests within the land to divide it up. There's a case cited in our brief that involves surface and subsurface rights, and the court in that federal district or federal circuit said the condemnor does not have to divide between the surface and subsurface rights. It is not liable for interest once it pays for that property, and the fact that the claimants within that property cannot come to an agreement in a rapid fashion is essentially their own fault for creating such a mess of the ownership within this piece of land or parcel. And the condemnor is not responsible for that. That's why I say there is no just compensation concept within eminent domain context in this case, because it is clear that no one claims Glendale owes Bayshore any more money for interest. And so this isn't really about condemnation. This is about whether Bayshore can take the money from the clerk. And if that's the case, there's no way to distinguish this case from any other case where the clerk has private money in his account, whether it's bail, whether it's surety, whether it's interpleader. And if that's true, then we are opening up a fairly broad situation to the payment of interest.
It seems to me that the city of Glendale clearly doesn't owe any more money, but the money is transferred to the people who own it, and they ought to be able to have some say in it.
As an abstract principle, that may be correct on an equitable basis, perhaps, but my reaction is the legislature has decided who is entitled to the money here, and they've made a conscious decision in 1979 to say, we're going to let clerks invest these funds, and funds like these funds, not just condemnation awards, but other funds like these funds, and keep the interest. The litigation cost of time is the litigant's cost. In normal situations, we do not compensate litigants for the cost of the time of litigation. And this case, again, Bayshore will try to argue that this case is special because it's a condemnation award. And the gut reaction, I'm sure, is to say that's right. But that is not the case here because no one claims the condemnor owes interest.
Now, is a fine or forfeiture, you talked about fines, other things. You're comparing that a condemnation award is the same as a fine as far as the keeping in the clerk's fund?
I would not say the same as a fine because
you mentioned fines.
Yeah, fines and forfeitures are public monies clearly and owed to the government and they belong to the government. But all these other situations I was talking about, like minor settlements, interpleader actions, sureties, security for costs of non-Wisconsin plaintiffs, sureties or undertakings for appeal, those are all monies paid into court to be held by the clerk of circuit court for the benefit of the party who paid it in, depending on the outcome of the litigation.
And it says that for the benefit of...
No, that's my language. But that is the effect of it. It's being held to see what happens at the outcome of the litigation. It's not a constitutional right. It's a right that these people have paid money into court. I do not believe anyone would argue that in every single one of those situations, I pay bail because I'm up for a criminal charge. I am found innocent that when the court returns my bail to me, it has to return it with interest. And that the court, the circuit court, may decide the bail in this case is $500,000, and I'm going to take that bail from the clerk and invest it in a bank.
But that's different because it's dependent upon your being found innocent or guilty or whatever in its return. But this is where, as I'm arguing, it seems to be, and I take that back, I am arguing, but I'm making a statement that it seems to me that this is for property that was taken. There is a constitutional impediment that we're talking about, you know, although you don't want to bring that in here, but there's an overview of condemnation statutes. You have to comply with certain statutory requirements. And that's so I just wanted to talk about what the benefit is, and you say the benefit is simply holding the money as it was with fines, but then you went back and used some other examples.
And in the condemnation statutes, in Chapter 32, 05, sub 9, it talks about appeals, for example. And if there's an appeal over the size of the condemnation award, and if the condemnee is successful in that appeal, the statute provides for payment of interest. And likewise, if the condemnee is unsuccessful and the award is lessened, there's a statute that deals with that. And again, there's a statute that deals with a situation where if there's an appeal of the award over the total amount of the award, and there is also competing interest between the claimants to that award, the statute specifically says no interest shall be owed by the condemnor because of that dispute between the claimants and their inability to resolve it. If we allow litigants to put this money anywhere they feel like, number one, it doesn't encourage any resolution of this litigation. The claimants then, it encourages them or discourages them from a prompt resolution of that claim. Now, Bayshore will obviously argue that there's a lot of money at stake and we're going to try and get it as fast as we can. But if they're earning a reasonable market rate of return, the incentive isn't the same as if they're not earning any return and the money is going to the clerk. I think that's a valid public policy to encourage resolution of these claims. It's the fact that these, in this situation and ones like it, that the litigants or the property owners, the owners within this piece of property have created this arguably nightmarish layer of 15, 14 leases in this piece of property, a bank with a security interest, the property owner. that because they can't figure out who owns what within this property or the value of who owns what within this property, that's what's creating the problem. It's not the condemnor, it's not the clerk, it's not the court. And so I, again, don't think that the legislature intended to subsidize that litigation by allowing them to take the money from the clerk and put it in some private bank account. I haven't spoken to inherent authority, and I think the inherent authority is an argument that's fairly straightforward if there is a constitutional right to interest, which we disagree that there is. But if there is, clearly the court has the authority, inherent or otherwise, to fashion a remedy to protect that constitutional right. And I would never argue to the contrary of that. But it rests on the assumption that there is a right to interest, which we do not believe there is a right to interest. And if there is no constitutional right to interest, then we're falling back on the statute. And the statute clearly gives the right to interest and the right to invest to the clerk.
Unless, counsel, we rely on 32057 and interpret for the benefit as a statutory right, correct? And then couldn't the court protect that statutory right with its inherent authority?
That's obviously what Judge Fein believed in his dissent. And obviously, if that's the logic you wish to follow, that would be the conclusion. I disagree. The Court of Appeals, the majority disagree. The clerk disagrees with that position because I do not believe that anything in 5943C trumps the placement of the award in the custody of the clerk that is found in 32057D. And the for the benefit language, I see no logical or reason on its face why that language has to include the assumption that the interest accrued on that award has to be paid to them. The money, the award, is placed for the benefit of the owners, meaning that award is to be held for them. It doesn't say anything obvious on its face about an interest.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Grady, I know your red light came on, so I'm almost hesitant to ask this question, but I have one other issue I'd like you to briefly address. That deals with your argument regarding the transfer fee under 5725, and more specifically, as you address that, what impact of any 81461 sub 12A2 has with respect to the circuit court's authority?
I'm going to have to look that up because I don't have it on top of my head. Do you have it? Yeah.
Let me focus my question because it puts you at a disadvantage to throw this in at the end of the argument. 12A2 under 81461, if the clerk is required by court order or by law to deposit any of the funds in sub 1 in an account in a bank, savings and loan association, or other suitable financial institution, the type of account shall be in the clerk's discretion unless the court specifies a particular type of account in its order. Now, this is the one that would arguably allow you to collect a transfer fee. This seems to suggest a little bit broader authority of the circuit court to kind of direct where money goes. And nobody's argued that. I didn't see that in the briefs. But I'm sitting here looking at the statute, and this is your backup argument. And the reason why it intrigues me is it seems, to me at least, that there might be some economic incentive in the clerk making some types of investment if their fee can go up based upon the nature of the investment. The fee that the county can retain goes up based on the nature of the investment they make.
Well, the fee under the statute is not tied to the nature of the investment. The fee is tied to a percentage of the fund itself, of the principal.
Okay. Gotcha.
Of the principal.
Okay.
So the nature of the investment wouldn't affect the clerk's fee under this statute.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. But if you address the transfer fee argument just briefly.
My response on the fee argument is, number one, the Court of Appeals says the clerk's entitled to a fee in this situation. Number two, if the circuit court is exercising its inherent authority under 5943C to take this money for the benefit of the property owners, then that implies with it the fee of the statute as part of that discretionary inherent authority, if you will. It is also clearly true, as my opponent points out, that the language of the statute quite literally says the person who asks that the money be transferred has to be the same person who put the money in. And by its terms, it does not seem to apply. But again, the Court of Appeals suggested in the Bronfman case that this is a reasonable method of handling the situation, and the payment of the fee would go with it. And it also would fit with the notion of inherent authority of a circuit court. Thank you, Justices.
Well, Mr. Grady, I want to apologize for my remark, but I was looking at something. I was trying to get a question in here.
I know. You were very frustrated. I didn't help out.
But you made an excellent argument. So,
thank you, Justice.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Grady. Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by making sure I was very clear about my reference to the uniqueness of the for the benefit of language. Mr. Grady accurately points out that the word has been used, and even the phrase for the benefit of has been used in multiple places in the statute. However, my point was that this is unique with respect to a directive that money be deposited with the clerk. There's all kinds of funds and monies that can be deposited with the clerk and multiple statutes to provide for that. There is only one statute that says that that money gets deposited for the benefit of someone. And here it's the owners of the award. Next, I'd like to just touch on 3205 sub 7 sub D as a source of the clerk's claimed authority to, as the justice put it, sit on the money. That, to the extent that 3205 mentions the clerk, it is simply to identify where the condominor should put the money. That is significantly different from creating a substantive right in the clerk to hold on to the money once it gets there. It is simply designating the depository where the condominor knows, as a safe harbor, I can put the money so I can take the property. Housekeeping matter, I will note that the condemnation award is not in any of the clerk's accounts. It was taken entirely outside of the clerk's account and outside of the clerk's authority. It was deposited in the U.S. Bank under the court's authority. The court maintains exclusive authority over those funds. The order specifically says that nothing can be dispersed absent an order of the court. We are not.
What is the principal protected? It's obviously over the $100,000 or whatever it is that is insured by FDIC.
I do not know the level of the protection. It is in money market account. To the extent that security is an issue, it is something that can be brought up by any of the interested parties, and no one can express any concern about the security of the funds. And with respect to the question about what if there is a loss in the principal during the pendency of litigation, and would the county bear any responsibility for that, I think the nearly obvious answer is no, of course they wouldn't. The money has been taken from their possession by a court authority. They've been relieved of all responsibility and authority for those funds. And if it makes the county more comfortable, I will forgive them right here and now for any responsibility for those funds. That is simply not an issue in this case. We are not asking for interest from the county. They have earned approximately $20,000 for the month that it was sitting in their account. We have not asked the court, although I believe that there is a theory upon which we could. It is not presented in this case, and we have not asked the court for a transfer of that interest. We asked for a transfer of the principal so that it would be deposited in an account where it would bear interest for the owner.
Mr. Kelly, wouldn't the Douglas County case run counter to any request for interest from the county?
I think that, are you referring to Bronfman, Your Honor?
Yes.
However that is pronounced. Interest against the county could only be premised on them being a condemning authority, I think. Simply as a depository, I don't think that a condemnee would have any claim of interest to make the county pay. With this small caveat, I think as a constitutional matter, And I don't think we need to get too far down into the weeds on the constitutional part of this argument, but as a constitutional matter, I believe there is a right to interest that cannot be superseded by any statute. And the United States Supreme Court has specifically stated that. Interest is part of just compensation. Just compensation cannot be limited by statute. So I think Bronfman can most accurately be viewed as a waiver case. A person can always waive their constitutional rights. If you leave funds on deposit with the clerk with an immediate right to claim interest on that and you don't, I think it is fair to interpret that as a waiver of that interest to the point that you make the
deposit. And that's literally what happened in that Bronfman case.
Correct. They waited until the cessation of the proceedings and then asked retroactively for interest. Here we have not asked for retroactive interest, just for transfer of the funds so that would draw interest for our benefit. On one small point on the constitutional issue, I do not believe that there is any constitutional significance to a deposit of an unallocated fund when the failure to allocate is because there are multiple owners of several parcels as opposed to several legal interests in a single parcel. I think the operative paradigm with the constitutional piece is this. At all times, I must hold in my hand one of two things: title to my property or the compensation therefore. If at any time I don't hold one of those in my hand, interest accrues and somebody pays that. The fact that the condemning authority deposits an unallocated sum is an act by the condemning authority that prevents me from immediately obtaining the use of those funds. That is a volitional act by that condemning authority. It is no different constitutionally than if they had deposited the funds and objected to the distribution until an allocation had been made. The point is that at all times the property owner must have one of those two things, and if he doesn't, interest accrues.
Mr. Kelly, your light's on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both, Mr. Kelly and Mr. Grady, for excellent arguments today on an issue we haven't faced before. Thank you, and we are in recess. The court will meet at 3:15 in closed conference and at 9:45 tomorrow for another set of oral arguments. Thanks. Drive home, Kate.